Salutations. It's the podcast for a Friday. It's the end of the week, not quite the end of the month. Although the golf season is winding down, I'm chagrined to inform you, Shannon. My golf club is closing in 2 weeks.
Wow.
So I'll be tapping on your door for an invitation to your joint. Something that never
comes. I don't think any course is going to last very long now, Bob. It's for some reason October and fall and golf don't really go hand in hand at times.
Well,
and then I can't find the ball under the leaves.
That is a problem. And I even went to a yellow golf ball, which is really bad in the fall because the leaves are yellow.
My eyes, they blurry my eyes, those things.
Let's bring our guests in. Joining us from the Toronto Star and TSN, a longtime friend, Bruce Arthur is with us. And from the Buffalo News, our friend Mike Harrington joins us. Let's start with last night's Dodger game, and specifically this, a question that I think we've probably all discussed several times over the years, and no more appropriate time to readdress it than now. And that is, what is up with Clayton Kershaw in the postseason? This is one of the great pitchers of all time. Well, at least theoretically, everybody
thinks he's getting paid that way.
Well, yes. Everybody thinks he's a Hall of Famer. I'm not here to suggest he isn't. But when postseason comes, he is not the same guy. Harrington, you laughed at the mere mention of Kershaw's name. What do you see? What do you think?
Well, the biggest thing I see is they haven't made the World Series or won a World Series since 1988. They simply don't get far in the postseason because your ace pitcher doesn't pitch like your ace. And at this point now, you do start to wonder how much is in his head, how much the Atlanta Braves should not be beating the Dodgers in this series. And Clayton Kershaw just doesn't get the job done. He doesn't make big pitches in big spots. He gives up big innings, and that's the reason the Dodgers simply never get over the hump. Their ace pitcher in the postseason never acts like their ace. They don't get far.
Arthur, I take no joy in suggesting that anybody is a choker, but does this apply to Clayton Kershaw?
Well, okay, so there's – in the theory in baseball is that we've come to see that starters don't go as long as they used to because third time through the lineup or even fourth time through the lineup, your velocity drops and the batters figure you out. Except that that doesn't explain Madison Bumgarner, right? Like Madison Bumgarner was able to do this, was able to be a postseason pitcher, and part of that maybe was his style. People love chasing high heat. Maybe that's it, but – I have to think at some point with Clayton Kershaw, he's too good for this not to be at least a little bit mental. Because is he tipping pitches? I don't think so. Is it that other teams in the playoffs actually look at him and figure out what he's throwing? That can't be it. He's been around too long. It has to be something with what he is doing. And at that point, the choking happens. And it's just part of how your body responds to stressful situations and can you replicate what you do well in those moments. And it's starting to become clear, and it's really too bad that Clayton Kershaw might not have that.
But here's the thing with even last night. Kershaw was okay, good enough through five innings. He was fine. It was only a single run he allowed. And you know what, Dave Roberts, what he did was he said, well, you know what, my rule normally is my starter goes five innings and I'm taking him out, but it's Clayton Kershaw. I'm going to leave him in for a sixth. Maybe he should just apply the regular rules to Kershaw that he applies to everybody else. And because we probably would have criticized Kershaw or Roberts for leaving Kershaw in or taking him out anyway. It doesn't matter.
And let's be honest, John, the bullpen – screwed it up for the Dodgers.
Sure they did.
But I mean, they came in and ignited the fire.
The bullpen's the other big story for the Dodgers in this whole series. Ever since the previous series when Kenley Jansen kind of evaporated.
But the other big story here, I think everybody's going to say, look at the Dodgers. They're not going to get over the hump again. When are we going to say, you know, the Atlanta Braves have been really good the whole postseason. Yeah. Really good in this series except for the first inning of game three.
Mike,
you know,
Mike,
we're forgetting that.
Mike, we had a round table last Friday with John Morosi and Dan Schulman. We went for 40 minutes. We mentioned the Braves for 10 seconds. I mean, and literally, I if you go back and check it, folks, I said to Bob, I said, Bob, Alex Anthopoulos is going to be mad at you because you did not mention the Braves. And everybody said, nah, the Dodgers. The Dodgers are that good. The Dodgers are the best team. They didn't. Nobody gave the Braves, at least on our roundtable, a chance to win.
We should not have been doubting Alex Anthopoulos if we learned the lessons of 2015, yeah. Right?
Well, that name rings a bell, right? Alex Anthopoulos. It's a funny thing because he did work for the Dodgers, right? And the Dodgers, he was just part of a giant, like they had like nine GMs with the Dodgers when he was there. He was just responsible one part of it. That's basically that one of the theories of how the Dodgers work is if you have more players that you can be in on, you might as well have more general managers to go and scout and talk to people and all of that. Doesn't always work, but they've come close. What Anthopoulos has done with Atlanta is really awesome, right? Like, I'm not even sure that he wanted to wind up there, but he wound up there. And I've gone over this so many times that he still should be in charge of the Toronto Blue Jays, right? He still should be running this the Toronto Blue Jays, and I think they'd be in better shape, a very different team probably if he was. But what I'm just really happy for him, and the Braves look like a team. They look like a team that really isn't afraid of the moment at all. Like with Clayton Kershaw, let's say it's his back, right? Let's say it's something else. Let's say there's all these other things that are going on. But the Dodgers have not in those moments been the team that you want them to be. And the Braves just keep doing it and doing it and doing it. And there's a fearlessness to how they're playing right now. And maybe it's easy when you're seeing the ball like that.
And it spreads from Alex Anthopoulos. It's the old theory, winners win. It doesn't matter where they go, they just win. And that's what Alex Anthopoulos is doing here. He's a winner and he's winning again. And like you said, he never should have been out of Toronto. Now he's winning in Atlanta.
And look, we are all guilty of historic references, and the Atlanta Braves for a decade were probably the best team in baseball and won, one World Series during that whole time. And, you know, look, there's not a single person left in that organization, I don't think, that was with them back then. And so that reference is irrelevant. And yet, it's sort of in the back of your mind every time you see them that you expect them to, you know, cough up the bit, and they might still, but they're completely different.
Bob, how many years has it been since the Braves won a series?
Good question. I don't know.
2014 years.
Yeah. 2006.
Yeah. Yeah. We have this malaise about the Braves. They're always there. Oh, Bobby Cox. He always does something, you know. I mean, name Chipper Jones. I mean, name a guy, and they became part of the furniture. It's been a while. It's not as if it was 2 years ago.
And but you say you to guys, yourself, "Who is Brian Snitker? Who is Brian Snitker?" You know, you I go. Mean, he's not Bobby Cox.
But come on, I mean, you know, I
respect him. Who he is. He's wearing a mask.
I respect what John said, you know, about our conversation last week, and we overemphasized the Dodgers, but the Dodgers looked like the best team going into the postseason. It looked like they would beat the Atlanta Braves and maybe steamroll them. And I don't, you know, I'm not going to put the blame Kershaw solely, but the Dodgers find a way to stub their toes almost on an annual basis at some point, don't they?
Their offense disappeared to the end of game two.
That's a big part of this is that the Dodgers, if you look at the lineups coming into this series, the Dodgers have a better lineup, right? Like the Dodgers should be able to
hit.
Sure
they do.
And like if you match up these teams all the way through, like the Braves, you can argue they got a better bullpen and that's about it. They lost Mike Soroka this year. They're a good team and they got a lot of young talent, but the Dodgers are the Dodgers, but you have to do it. But baseball is the ultimate big sample size sport, right? They didn't play 162 this year. And as a result, you think the standings are how they would have been if they'd done it the ordinary way? Probably not. But this Braves team, again, it's how you react in the moment. It becomes these individual little matchups. So it's not just Clayton Kershaw, because they've lit up the Dodgers bullpen too, which is excellent.
Tell you what, the top of the order, when you look at Acuna, Ozuna, and Freddie Freeman. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Well, we've all had a chance to see them a bit, and so now we recognize they're pretty good. Before this season started, or before even this playoff started, I'm not sure we would have said any of those things. Let's move away from baseball for the moment, unless you want to discuss the other series, which suddenly became interesting. Shannon's got his mouth open, so maybe he has something to say.
No, if we were going to move away from baseball, I wanted to ask, Mike saw more Jays games in the last 2 months than any of us did.
That's true.
Yeah, sorry, Mike.
I saw all 26 of them, every inning, me and all my cutout friends.
The only thing that jumps to mind after watching particularly the last two rounds of playoffs, is, boy, oh boy, the Jays got a lot of work still to do to get to the level of a couple of these teams.
They do. I mean, they got into the playoffs partly because they, like Bruce said, they manipulated the system. Would they have been a 92-win team in a 162-game season? Absolutely not. They were able to manipulate pitching to get through 60 games, have limited starters, use heavy bullpen, a lot of bullpen games. You know, the offense was inconsistent at times. They had a lot of hot streaks from guys like Teoscar Hernandez. And guys, don't underestimate the chip on the shoulder they played with and the way they actually used Salem Field and Buffalo to their advantage to score a lot of runs, get comfortable, and understand that most of the visiting teams didn't want to be there, especially the New York Yankees, who went 2-5 in Buffalo. So it was an unusual year that they used the disadvantage to their advantage, and they snuck in the playoffs. Good for them for doing it. But, yeah, I think going forward next year that you still have questions about Vladdy Guerrero. You still have a lot of questions about pitching. And they're going to have to answer a lot of those questions in the offseason and then figure out again, are we back to where we were again come February and March where they have no idea where they're going to play? If they're going to go to Dunedin, can they get into Toronto? It's still a huge question.
There's that Sorry, Bruce, go.
There's that problem for the Raptors as well. Are they going to be able to play and cross the border? But that's the next season thing. One thing with the Jays that could be to their advantage, there's a lot of teams in baseball that aren't trying to win, right? Like there's a ton of teams in baseball which aren't really pushing. And that's one thing, as Mike noted, the Jays pushed this year a little bit. Like they added at the deadline. They really tried to win. What you're seeing is when you watch Tampa play, and when you're watching even, I mean, Houston too, to a degree, but like take a look at the Dodgers, take a look at the Braves. You got to be so good, right? You just, There's so many ways that, I mean, we can say this in any sport, but it's a reminder. You have to have so many different parts of your team that are durable, that are robust, that are not only that, but are can get you to the moment and then play in the moment. The Jays have a base of young talent and it's something, and they have maybe a desire to really win. We'll see. Those two things are kind of what they're starting with. There's still a ways to go.
And I mean, they're just not deep enough. And then the frustration is that when you see, I mean, I'm working on my computer watching the baseball and somebody mentioned Aaron Loop's name the other night. And next thing you know, Aaron Loop's in the game and Aaron Loop's really pitching well. Mm-hmm. And you're going, oh my goodness gracious. I mean, what happened? You know, how many different ways can this organization, I know they're getting better. I know that they've got some bright young stars, but how do they get to that next level? That really, to me, is the next question. I'm sure it's the question that Shapiro and Atkins are asking every day.
Look at the Rays, how good they are in all these areas. The Jays are not good defensively. The Rays are good defensively. Uh-huh. They're good offensively. They situational pitch. They situational hit. The Jays still have a long way to go.
Yeah, and Aaron Loop has had as many bad days as he's had good days. You probably just caught him on a good one.
Yeah, I caught him on a good day, Bob.
I've seen a few bad ones, too. Let's change gears a little bit. We have no idea when the next NHL season is going to start. We have no idea what the configuration is going to be. And yet Bill Foley, the owner of the Vegas Golden Knights, in the last 24 hours or so.
Your favorite team.
Yeah, thank you. Made it clear that he believes there will be a Canadian division next year on a one-year kind of deal. Good, bad, obvious. What do you make of it, Bruce?
Obvious is probably the first one because that border is not opening anytime soon. It's just not. Like, it's just the virus is now out of control in the United States to a degree that it hasn't been yet. And I'm really hoping that Mike and his family are safe because if you look at the daily case counts, we're becoming numb to it, but it's really, really bad. So the next part is what came out of the NBA is that they're not going to do a bubble again. it was really expensive and it was really hard on the people in it. And you saw a little bit of that from the NHL too. They don't like this. They don't like being away from their families for 2 months. And you certainly can't do it for regular season if you can barely pull it together for a postseason. So they want to play in their arenas. They want to try, both sports want to try to do this. Having an all-Canadian division would be awesome. And it would be the only, it'd be the most logical thing that you could do. But the thing is, it's only one part of this whole thing. Right, it's not like the Canadian teams are just going to play each other 82 times. So how do you, how are you going to mesh Canada and the United States? And I mean, the Raptors can go play in Buffalo, right? If they can go play somewhere else.
I brought this for you to right do here.
It in the NHL.
Can you see this?
Is that is that Ernie De Gregorio?
There you go. I'm trying to get the right view for you guys to see it. There you go. There you go.
Buffalo Braves, yeah.
There you go. Just but for like, you guys, so, knowing we did not have an MLB-ready stadium for the Blue Jays. We do have an NBA-ready arena, just for the record, in case the Raptors need it.
Yeah, stay tuned. We'll let you know.
It's going to be really complicated because the fact is there's just Canada's going to have its own problems, it seems like, in the fall, where we have our own issues. But we're in a lot better shape. And it just to go back and forth is going to require Herculean negotiations to even have it as an option, especially on a regular basis. We're seeing in the NFL now, a team every week has positive tests. And that's a sport that only has 16 games.
Now, I don't know really if I complex. Agree with that, though. Is Canada's in better shape? Is it in a lot better shape? Look what's going on in Ontario right now. Look what's going on in Quebec right now. I think there's a real problem going on in Canada, too. I think there's a lot more attention to the ridiculous nature of the way the United States has dealt with this virus. But, you know, we're seeing in the NFL right now all these problems and all these breakouts, and in college football. We didn't see that in hockey because they were in the bubble. What happens when hockey tries to travel and tries to go to these arenas?
Same thing as every other sport.
Right. I mean, how are we going to be dealing with rescheduled games and all this stuff that's going to go on? It's going to be very difficult for them to play a season. And I know Gary Bettman was asked during his Stanley Cup final press conference, Elliot Friedman asked the question a lot of us were thinking, is there a chance you guys don't play until September or October of 2021? And his answer was absolutely not. We're going to have a season. It's going to be real hard to have a season, guys. I'm not feeling optimistic. I'm not feeling pessimistic. I'm just, how are they going to do this?
I worked for the commissioner. He can change his mind. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing. The other thing becomes in watching, and we know that the NBA and the NHL have watched Major League Baseball, are watching what's going on in the National Football League. The question will become is how their chief medical officers will build their travel schedules and basically align from the hotel to the arena and back to the airport. And what I would describe as mini bubbles for 2 or 3 days, is it even possible? The big issue becomes we're now in the hockey world and the basketball world where we were with Major League Baseball in the spring before the season started. How much money will the players get? Will they be willing to do that? Will they be willing to play for percentages as opposed to expecting their full salaries? I think there's going to be a lot of battles beyond the COVID battle before we see hockey or basketball again.
Well, I think Mike made the point earlier. I mean, it might have been Bruce. I can't recall. How do you – you can't expect all seven Canadian teams to just play each other. Well, get ready because exactly what's going to happen. That's
well, I think that what I think what they're thinking about doing is that everything is in increments. So basically, you do a 60 or a 75 game schedule with increments. The first 30 games with no fans between the Canadian teams and then other U.S. based divisions. You then hope and have your fingers and toes crossed that by let's say April 1st. That we're allowed to travel between the two countries, and you're allowed to put 6,000 people in the game, in the buildings. You know, both Foley and Eugene Melnyk in the Financial Post this week talked about, you know, we've got to put some people in the seats at some point in order to try to generate some local revenue. That's the other part of this, is I don't think there's going to be an appetite for NHL owners to go in and play a whole season or the potential of a whole season with no fans.
Shut the bleeping thing down. You know, I don't care what Foley thinks or Melnick thinks. You cannot play right now with people in an enclosed arena and make it work. And even if there's 2,000 or 3,000, the impact of that economically is irrelevant. The point of the matter is this: you can't cross the border. There's no prospect of crossing the border anytime soon. Number two, you can't play an 82-game schedule if you're going to start in January. At some point, you got to catch up. And to plan an 82-game schedule starting in January in the middle of COVID is lunatic time. That makes no sense. So you play a 40-game season or whatever. And in that scenario, the regular season is the 7 Canadian teams play each other and the American teams play each other and you...
Well, you could actually do for the sake of argument, a 36 game schedule in those pods, in those divisions, or maybe even a bit more. You play each team 6 times, and then you go to a playoff scenario in a bubble.
Exactly, and that's what's got to happen.
Do the bubble. So, this is a league, and the four of us have been around for both of them, where 48 game schedules and playoffs existed. And Stanley Cup winners were, and their names are engraved on the trophy. So we shouldn't really worry about the length of the schedule as we should be whether there's going to be a season period or not.
Bruce?
This is actually the complicated part. The bubble, everyone at the end of the bubbles for both the NBA and the NHL said, what an amazing job they did, right? They created these safe places and they pulled the whole thing off. And that's true. But that's actually kind of the easy thing. All the NHL and the NBA did is consult a lot of really smart medical experts who say, test, trace, isolate, and keep your people away from the outside world. Mm-hmm. And if it's complicated. It's not that complicated. The theory is pretty easy. Once you live out in the world, once you have community prevalence where you live, and it's a big difference if you live in Arizona versus living right now in Buffalo. Buffalo's doing actually pretty well. Terrific. It's a big difference living in Toronto than it is, say, in Winnipeg, although Winnipeg's starting to go up, right? Like, there's differences. But once your guys want to go to a restaurant, once your guys want to go to a bar, once your guys go and meet people in the community, just the odds go up. So it's going to be harder. The other thing on revenues, we saw what happened to ratings of almost every sport, right? They cannibalized each other. They were strange times of the year. And you saw overall sports viewership was up. Individual sports viewership was down because everyone was watching everything else. And so how does that affect your revenues going forward? And how desperate does that make owners, especially a guy like Melnick, right? Or the owners who don't have the same cash flow as they ordinarily would. That becomes the scary part, I think, for a lot of owners.
Some of these owners, remember, don't want to open the building. They don't want to play at all if there's no fans. Right. They would prefer to have the thing shut down than to try it with no fans or limited fans. And that's something I think doesn't get enough discussion, that the outside business interests have all been killed for a lot of these owners. Then they lose the revenue from sports. They don't want to open up. I think that's a real issue for the NHL and the NBA. How many teams don't even want to play?
And file this away. If the Tokyo Olympics start, it's not the window, basically the month of August, it's half of July.
Yep.
So you're going to want to have, if you're a commissioner of one of those two leagues, you're going to want to be finished by the 10th or 12th of July in order to get some airtime in the United States.
Is it even realistic, though, to think in this world we're going to have this figured out, to have an Olympics in Japan in July? How realistic does that seem?
The Olympics is literally the worst idea in the pandemic world, right? It is literally the only thing in the world where you bring someone from every single country, jam them together for 3 weeks, and then send them home. Like the IOC, there's so much money on the line for the IOC on this. And so they kind of think about how they planned this. They said, well, we're just going to do it in a year. We're going to hope it's going to work.
Right.
Well, okay, so the fact it's in the summer is going to help. We've seen that there's seasonality, at least in the Northern Hemisphere, that'll work out in our schedules. But you still have the difference in countries. There's so many second waves right now. We don't know when vaccines come. We don't know how easily vaccines are adopted. And we don't know how quick it is to get vaccines out. Like in Canada, what I've been told, because I've been reporting on this for like 6 months now, is that the vaccines we're betting on all have different timelines. But you really can't expect any until about the middle of next year to be actually distributed to the population. That's on a good timeline if they work. That's Canada, which is a rich country and has bet on 7 different vaccines.
And people have to use them too, Bruce.
Exactly. This is going to be so complex. Can the Olympics exist as a bubble the way you did it with the NBA and the NHL, where everyone from all over the world comes and quarantines for 2 weeks and then lives inside that bubble and then goes home? That's the only way to do this. It would cost an enormous amount of money and be so complex.
A bunch of other things I want to get to here. Here's a quickie, I don't know there's any relevance to this topic at all. Joe Thornton's name popped up. He's, what, 41 years old now, played for about 100 years. Somebody wrote a story and suggested that Thornton to the Leafs is not beyond the realm of a possibility.
They've talked, Bob. They've talked about it.
Okay, but here's the part. In the story, the premise was that Thornton would want to go to the Leafs because they have a great shot at winning the Stanley Cup. Am I losing my mind here?
Win a round. When are the Leafs going to win a round?
The guy from Buffalo has been waiting 44 minutes to say that.
Win the cup? Thornton would have a good chance of winning the cup if he went to the Toronto Maple Leafs?
No, he wouldn't.
For the record, the Leafs didn't make the playoffs last year. They made the postseason.
Yes.
Make the playoffs.
All right, we covered that topic.
Here's the thing. Let me finish. So I don't think the Leafs should want to get older and slower. Don't you think they've learned their lesson about having a veteran player from San Jose come and play?
Clearly not.
Well, I mean, Kyle's smarter than that. So I think they floated it. I think they've just talked about it. And I don't know where Joe Thornton would play anyway. And would he get 8 minutes a game? It doesn't make any sense.
If you take a look at the bottom half of the Leafs lines right now, they're not that good, right? Trading Johnsson and trading Kapanen means their depth went and you replace those with like Wayne Simmonds. That's not an upgrade, right? In terms of skill, in terms of offensive depth. And they're still not sure Alexander Kerfoot's a center. So that right now is your third line center and Jason Spezza is your fourth line center, but you can play him on the wing. Thornton would give you a fourth line center and a little more insurance. The one thing with Joe is whenever I've gone to San Jose and I've done that California trip a few times, he's got an awesome deal there, man. No one bugs him at the rink. He doesn't have to talk to anybody he doesn't want to. I've been there and he's left to go pick up his kids halfway through practice because he can do that. Cause he's been Joe in San Jose for a million years and he lives in Northern California and it's pretty nice. He walks around without a shirt a lot. You don't get to do that in Toronto very often.
But this is the classic case of the local kid yearning to play for the big team. This is a classic case, and perhaps Kyle will let him do it. And if I'm Joe Thornton, and I wanted to, first of all, if I was Joe Thornton, he married a woman from Davos, Switzerland. He lives in Davos, Switzerland a lot in the off season. He's playing for Davos right now. What a great way to finish! What a great way to finish his career.
Yeah, stay there.
Yeah,
Leafs have Spezza anyway, so they got a geezer on the roster that is a marginal contributor. This drives me crazy. I confess I'm a traditionalist, and which I guess means I'm old. But the greatest uniforms in the world are uniforms that have essentially not changed. Yeah, okay, the Toronto Maple Leafs, the Chicago Blackhawks. Well, the original six uniforms for the most part. The New York Yankees, the LA Dodgers, you know, on and on and on and on and on. I hate it when teams change uniforms. And the Toronto Raptors have decided to go down that rabbit hole again with, I don't know, they got three new uniforms and then two others they're going to unveil, plus a closet full that they probably will drag out once or twice a year. Does this piss anybody else off besides me? Harrington, say something.
Yes, Absolutely it does. I mean, at least the Buffalo Sabres are going back this year to royal blue, like mm-hmm. they had in the 70s and 80s in their glory days. Throwbacks are the big thing now. The Raptors, it just comes off as sales. Let's sell more jerseys. Let's have six or seven jerseys. You know, to me, you can have a classic basketball jersey. And Bruce, you, the amount of time you're on the NBA, you know what really aggravates me in the NBA?
Boston Celtics.
Boston Celtics. They messed with the Boston Celtics jerseys. I still want to hate JoJo White for that free throw to beat the Braves in 1974 when that terrible foul was called on McAdoo, and they messed with the Boston Celtics jerseys. So yeah, Bob, you really you hit one on me.
Hold on here, Mike. How many? I mean, I know you've got your your Buffalo Braves sweatshirt on, your hoodie. It's not cut off at the arms for Belichick's honor,
right?
But they're not doing this for us.
No,
You're not going to buy a jersey and wear it. But there are people between the ages of 14 and 30 that will do this constantly.
And but that's why do the Raptors need six jerseys, John?
Yeah, screw
because
those
they can
people.
Sell six times more.
I couldn't care less about those.
And that's
people.
Welcome to the business. Why are we doing a podcast?
Different kinds of sourcing in the supermarket. Right.
Right.
But wait, listen, when you go to a supermarket, look at the salad dressing aisle. I worked in a supermarket once, and one of the ways that we'd haze new employees is say, can you go shake the oil and vinegar because it settles? Right. So you'd get someone to go shake the oil and vinegar in the salad dressing aisle, and they'd come back and say, I don't know, it settles again after I do it. But like there's a million different salad dressings, not because we need a million different salad dressings. We do that because it's the illusion of choice, right? But this is the same thing with the Raptors. It's not like they had beloved jerseys that they won a championship in last year that might have some historic resonance. No, let's ditch them after a year because we can market. But the thing that bothers me more about the NBA jerseys, you want to talk about the Boston Celtics. Yeah, those gray jerseys they have are awful. The black ones
are awful.
The black ones. Terrible.
Well, but the Lakers.
But they also have ads on the jerseys.
Well, yeah.
And that's the one that actually bothered me more in a way, because the Celtics can still wear their classic jersey, but their classic jersey now says GE. And I just didn't add for GE. Good job, idiot. This is why they do it, right? Like, but what's happened is, like, there's a reason that we don't sit courtside at NBA games anymore. So they can make a whole lot of money selling those courtside seats to somebody else. And there's a reason that you don't have two jerseys anymore. You got six or seven or eight, because that way it is market penetration. And I don't love it. I don't love any of these new Raptors jerseys particularly. Again, they literally won a title in pretty good jerseys last year.
Yeah. But they weren't good
marketing
enough.
Marketing people got to do something, right? Like,
we all know why they're doing it. We're not arguing the reasons behind it. We get it. They want to sell shit. You know? Yeah. It's okay. We understand that. But you got enough jerseys to sell. You brought back those ugly pinstripe things from 1995. Yeah. You know, okay, people bought those. Lowry wore one, didn't he, at the parade? Didn't he have one of those on? Yeah. He had Stoudemire's jersey or something on?
This is like how once in a while I'll see Vancouver Grizzlies gear out there. And God bless the Vancouver Grizzlies. I had a mini pack season ticket thing with my dad and my brother. We'd go to like 15 games a year and watch them lose. But though, like, one of my defining, like, if I was going to be a bettor, I would never bet on teal in sports ever. Just teal is not a winning color. And it was an ugly color then. They were awful jerseys then. And somehow I've seen people I respect who have style wearing Vancouver Grizzlies gear. If you wait long enough, it like, it's the same thing with the Raptors jerseys. Those things were awful. Those were the pinstripe purple with a cartoon dinosaur. It was a joke. But if you wait long enough, the jersey becomes popular. And that's the one argument you can probably make to changing the jersey now, is that if you wait long enough, it'll look cool just by power of nostalgia. Yeah,
The other aspect of this is to bring it back, and then it becomes cool.
The other aspect of this is, it's another sign of technology, because it's easier now. Like in the 60s and the 70s, it was difficult to make jerseys and sweaters. It was intricate.
Yeah.
Science and technology now have allowed jerseys to be made easily. You know, whether it's the die cast or whether it's the logos, everything happens much simpler. So why not do it? I mean, to me, as much as I agree with you, and as long as at some point they maintain, the Celtics maintain the whites at home and the greens on the road, or vice versa at some point, I don't mind the other stuff every once in a while so that people can buy into it. Because you can't sell, when you're in the arena, you're only selling to 18,000. This way, if you have a different volume and a different choice, you can sell to hundreds of thousands of people.
You know what I'd like to see? What's the data on Detroit Red Wings jerseys, right? Because those don't change very much, and they're awesome.
They're
beautiful, right? But so take the jerseys that have not changed. I'd love to compare those, and you'd have to adjust for whether a team wins and their own baselines in each market. But like, do classic jerseys sell better or how much worse than having this market? I'm sure someone's done the maths on this, right? But I don't know. Being a traditionalist in sports is harder and harder, right? Like, being a traditionalist in any way is harder and harder. And in terms of stuff that people can sell, we never run out of that.
By the way, all right, look at the Stanley Cup champions sweaters. The simple blue and white of the Tampa Bay Lightning with a simple logo. But who do you think designed those? Steve Yzerman.
Did he really?
When he went to Tampa, he says, "We're going to redo the sweaters. We're going to make them look like a team that hasn't changed in 60."
I mean, I don't know that he sat down in his basement, you know, with his crayons, and drew the jerseys, John. So
I think he sat down with the artist and said, "This is what I want."
They kind of look like if you were going to reinvent a Detroit Red Wings sweater and make it blue and white and have a lightning bolt. Like, it's fairly simple. It's fairly, you're right, actually. I hadn't thought of that.
All right, quick. This is off the top of my head, around the table. Favorite jersey, any sport. If you could only have one in your closet, I don't know if you got any in your closet, but what's the best jersey out there? Harrington first.
The best jersey out there jumps at me right away.
Any sport.
The red Chicago Blackhawks jersey. That one, to me, I know now we're getting politically incorrect these days, and you wonder what its future is going to be. But to me, that is one that has always jumped off the page, kind of like the Red Wings. It looks good. Not just they play good. They play good in the 70s and 80s, too, and into the 90s. But those have always looked great. And then the building has 15,000 of them in the United Center when you go to watch a game. It's an unbelievable effect.
Bruce?
This is really, really hard because my favorite personal jersey is growing up in Vancouver, the skate, right? The one, not the Flying V. I grew up seeing the Flying V, and as much as I wasn't young enough to think that was cool, but the skate was always my favorite. But in terms of jerseys just out in the world, you know what? I was in an apparel store once, and I saw a Hartford Whalers jersey, the green.
Oh, really?
And
nice.
And they are gorgeous because it's got the whale tail coming up, which kind of has the beautiful jerseys. Love them. That might be my favorite, but you know one that also kind of jumps out in my mind? The Quebec Nordiques jerseys. I love the color combination. I love the fleur-de-lis. I love how they were singular. Those are probably two of my favorites. Maybe it's a nostalgia thing there too, right?
Yeah.
But then he had to watch Michel Bergeron behind the bench.
Channy, favorite jersey?
Well, I'll tell you what, it's interesting. You two guys both pick hockey sweaters. And it's amazing. Hockey sweaters they transcend the sport when it comes to, you know, celebrities wearing them. But I do not know how you beat the New York Yankees. I really don't. And for so many reasons. The pinstripe, the simplicity, no names on the home team, on the home jersey. And if somebody said, okay, you have to wear a jersey tomorrow to work, you have to wear one to work, I wouldn't be caught dead in a hockey sweater, but I might wear Joe DiMaggio, Mickey Mantle, Thurman Munson. I might wear a Yankee home jersey if I had to.
You're telling me you wouldn't wear a basketball jersey to work? Just show off the shoulders?
Well, with my pythons? I don't know.
I wasn't really bothered by the Nike ad. And going back to the NBA point, all the Nike ad and the baseball jerseys I thought was really going to bother me. The Dodgers, the Cubs, they were going to deface the jersey. It was relatively unobtrusive compared to some of the ads in the NBA.
That's because we're so used to seeing the swoosh on everything, Bruce.
Yeah. Well, on college football jerseys more than anywhere else. The correct answer was the first answer up, and that was the Chicago Blackhawks. That's the one that jumped out at me.
Those are gorgeous.
The other one that grabs me is not the Yankees, rather the Dodgers. And maybe there's some historic reference in that, but the blue. Well,
when you
and
were
the red,
four, when you were clean. Four, you, the first team you played for when you were four were the Dodgers.
Yeah, it was. But it wasn't those colors. They were actually. But those uniforms were black and yellow, with Dodgers across the front. The ones they wore in Brooklyn and the ones they now wear in Los Angeles. And again, it's another uniform that really hasn't changed over the years.
There's a regal aspect to both that and the Yankees, right? And part of that is history. And it's hard to unpack it from history and design, right? Because they're two different things. But it's the accumulated history that guys are wearing around on their shoulders. And that's part of what makes I think so powerful. It's like, we all have the table hockey set, and it was the Leafs and the Canadians, right? And those are powerful jerseys.
I tell you, Bruce, you when you were a kid, you were mad. You wanted to know why Tyco or Mattel, who built the hockey game, why was set? It was the Canucks set.
It's the Canucks. I knew why. It wasn't good.
All right. We're a little over time here, but one last thing. The Buffalo Bills get off to this amazing start of 4-0, and all right, look, nobody thinks they're going to run the table, but they are a very good football team, or at least they were for the first 4 weeks, and then they got shelled. Harrington, what happened, and if you're a Bills fan, are you teetering on the edge of a 20-story building contemplating leaping, or is this just a blip on the radar?
This was a blip. I mean, I think that they were – struggling to prepare for the week. They didn't know if they were going to Tennessee, if they were going to play Kansas City, and they have injuries on defense. Their defense was terrible. Their defense has not been as good this year as it was last year. They've got some guys who aren't healthy right now. Tennessee played a good game. I think the Bills are still probably an 11-win team, but we're going to see a lot and learn a lot Monday when they play Kansas City here to see, really see where they're going to be. But they have to figure out this defense because they now know that Josh Allen is probably an elite quarterback. They got Stephon Diggs. They got him a target. But defense has been the real issue here, and they have to figure it out going forward.
By the way, Mike, I loved his response after the game.
Allen?
Because he knows the defense isn't very good too. So he knows the only way they're going to win is if he has ball control.
Right.
And the only way that they're going to win is if he makes sure that the offense stays on the field a long period of time so he can't screw up. I thought, to me, that was the, and I mean, I get very critical of athletes. To me, that was the point where it showed his maturity and leadership more than any other time. And I have more confidence in the Bills now than I did before the game.
Tremendous accountability. Absolutely. Tremendous.
I think Mike's right. They're a bottom third defense, right? Like the defense, there have been times when they've made the playoffs, it's been the defense that's carried them. This has not been a team that's had a great quarterback until now. Like Josh Allen is, within a few years, could easily be the best quarterback in franchise history.
Possibly.
He's that talented. Yeah. He's on a meteoric rise. He gets it. Like that's a key part of this. And we weren't sure that Josh Allen was going to be one of those quarterbacks who gets it after games and says, this is on me and I need to be better. Like, it doesn't feel like he's trying to throw the ball through a window as often now, like to try to break the window. Like he's got crazy arm strength, and he's starting to learn how to use it. He is quietly a really good quarterback last year. He's elite. So whatever he does, working with an elite quarterback, and you can protect him a little bit, you've got a real chance to build something lasting. Like this is the most optimistic I've been about the Bills probably in 20 years.
Wait, hold on. Do you think you actually think that Allen will be better than Bob's favorite quarterback, Jack Kemp?
He's not my favorite quarterback, by the way.
I'm not sure he would be a better politician than Jack Kemp, but I think he could be a better quarterback.
Oh, don't. Bruce, we're almost wrapping this show up. Don't go there.
Don't open that Pandora, right.
It would have been wrapped up, Shannon, if you had kept your mouth shut. And then we wouldn't have to go down.
Well, if I kept my mouth shut, we wouldn't have a show.
Alan's going to put numbers together, but the thing is, can he ever, like Bruce said, can he become better than Jim Kelly? He has to win. Jim Kelly won a lot of football games. They got the 4 Super Bowls. They never got over the hump. But look at all the games they won during the season. That, to me, is the real indicator. Alan put up the stats. Can he put up the wins?
This is the best coach since that Super Bowl coach team, too. This guy, that's one of the reasons why Alan can grow.
I got to start somewhere, and so far he's been pretty good. That's all I can tell you. And where he winds up and what he's able to lead this franchise to remains to be seen. Boys, we have kept you longer than we intended, but we enjoyed it so much. And we thank you for coming on, and we hope you'll do it again. Harrington, all the best, pal. Stay safe in Buffalo.
Please let me cross the border someday.
Lovely to see you again, Bruce, and we'll chat again soon, I hope. Thanks. Thanks to all. We'll say goodbye. Have yourselves a swell weekend. Another podcast coming up next week. Well, Monday. Goodbye.